It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strangehamps.
And I'm Steve Paulson.
And this is the first episode of a new project we're launching this year called Luminous, a series on the philosophy and future of psychedelics.
I've been covering the psychedelic revival for the last decade, and there is a lot to talk about. Not just the new therapies we're likely to see in the next few years, but also big existential questions. The nature of consciousness and reality itself, and how psychedelics might change the way we approach the end of life.
They can ease the fear of death for patients with terminal diagnoses, but how and why?
What could psychedelics teach us about dying?
Well, nice to see you, Steve.
I'm so glad we could have this conversation now.
Yeah.
So how are you feeling now?
Well, on one hand, never better emotionally, spiritually. Medically, not so great. I have this stage 4 cancer diagnosis. It's been pretty resistant to treatment.
This is Roland Griffiths, arguably the most important psychedelic researcher of our time. The psychopharmacologist who brought psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, back into the field of medical research for the first time in decades. Roland died in October of 2023, 10 months after we taped this interview. I'd known him for years, and this was our last conversation. I was catching him in the middle of his chemotherapy. And listening back now, hearing his voice, it's so beautiful and for me, so heartbreaking. So this is a really daunting prognosis, and most people, I think, would be really scared or would be trying to just forget about the whole prospect of what's ahead and the thought of dying. You seem to be in a different place, and I'm wondering how you got there.
I wonder, too. It's really been quite fascinating because this came about after just a routine screening colonoscopy, came out of that with a significant colon tumor. And in just a few days, it was clear that it was metastatic to liver, meaning that it was a stage 4. And it was completely out of left field. It just seemed unreal to me, frankly. And then very quickly, when the kind of the depth of it finally came through, where I wanted to sit with this was in gratitude for the miracle of existence, the miracle of life, the fact that we're here as sentient, conscious creatures, aware that we're aware.
So you just decided that you wanted to have a more positive attitude and somehow that happened. You got there.
Yeah, but it's more than an attitude. I mean, I now have about 30 years of meditation experience. And the diagnosis was a phase shift. Whatever degree of awakeness I had previously was just ramped way higher. It's that. It's leaning into the present moment with the gratitude and the wonder and the curiosity of what we're doing here.
But what I find so fascinating, so amazing about what you're saying is you're saying, until you got this, essentially this terminal diagnosis, you couldn't fully lean in. You couldn't have that full awareness that you have now. You had to have that diagnosis to get there.
Well,
for you personally.
Yeah, for me personally. But my, yes, it came as this very powerful further awakening. It seems in principle it shouldn't take a terminal diagnosis, right? But and also it's a through line with the work with the psychedelics. And we've been doing work now for 25 years on psychedelic drugs. And they're close cousins in some sense of awakening experiences and this experience of existential wonder.
And I want to talk about that because the parallels between your personal experience now and some of your early studies of people who took psilocybin specifically to help them deal with end-of-life anxiety. I mean, wow. You are living what you studied.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was Roland Griffith's fascination with meditation that originally sparked his interest in studying psychedelics. At the time, no one could do this research legally, but Roland had an international reputation as an expert on drug addiction, and he persuaded Johns Hopkins University and various government agencies to allow him to run a clinical trial with psilocybin, specifically to see if it could elicit transcendent experiences. The results were remarkable. Of the 36 people in that first study, 61% had what Roland called mystical experiences. A follow-up study found 75% had them. And 14 months later, two-thirds of those people described this as one of the five most meaningful experiences in their lives. This is how he put it to me in 2010.
I would sit down with volunteers after these sessions and say, well, so what was it like? And very often people would kind of look at the floor and look away. And then they would start to describe the sense of the interconnectedness of all things, their heart opening. And it was amazing to me. I mean, I was sitting there talking to a newly minted mystic.
So what did you take away from this study? Did you come to, I don't know, philosophical conclusions about how we're wired, why we respond so strongly to a substance like psilocybin?
The fact that psilocybin can occasion these kinds of mystical type experiences that map on so clearly to naturally occurring or spontaneously occurring mystical experiences reported by mystics throughout the ages. The fact that it can do this with such high probability in so many people indicates that we're biologically wired to have these kinds of experiences.
At Johns Hopkins, Roland led a series of clinical trials with psilocybin for treating major depression and nicotine addiction. The results showed real therapeutic benefits. Perhaps the most dramatic results were for treating cancer patients who were scared of dying. In one study, published in 2016, a single large dose of psilocybin led to a significant drop in depression and anxiety. And after 6 months, 80% of those participants continued to feel less anxious and had more life satisfaction. So I want to get even more personal here, because up until very recently, you have not wanted to talk publicly about your own psychedelic experiences, and for understandable reasons. The whole field of psychedelic research has struggled for legitimacy for decades, and you have been the most visible scientist in the field over at least the last two decades. But since your cancer diagnosis, you have started to talk about your own experiences. So I have to ask you, have you had psychedelic experiences since your diagnosis?
Let me start from the beginning. So I had a few uneventful psychedelic experiences as a college student. They weren't meaningful, and frankly, I'd largely forgotten about them. And then it was after I initiated a meditation practice that I got really curious about the nature of inner experience. And so that was the motivation for starting the psychedelic work. And that work became astonishing to me. I mean, because people did have these incredible experiences to which they attributed this deep meaning and spiritual significance. But I did not re-engage personally with psychedelics until, oh, at least 10 years after we initiated those studies.
So, that's interesting. So you had been seeing the profound impact of this on all these people, and yet you didn't want to try this again yourself for 10 years.
Yeah, so there's such a prohibition against psychedelic use that I thought it would undermine my credibility as an investigator if I became a psychedelic proponent. But eventually curiosity got the better of me. And right. I have subsequently had, not a lot, but some experiences with different compounds. It has dovetailed in a very interesting way with what I've learned from meditation. You know, my own sense is that meditation is the tried and true way to investigate the nature of mind. And I think of psychedelics as, in some respects, meditation on steroids. And so to bring this up to the question about, well, so after the diagnosis, have you tried psychedelics? I did have a significant experience. In this case, it was with LSD. And I went in to use it as an opportunity to dialogue with the cancer.
So you asked your cancer questions during your LSD
I did.
Journey.
I did. And I did this repeatedly over the course of almost 12 hours. So I repeatedly returned to the two major questions. One is, what's going on here? Do I have to die? And the answer was, yeah, this is the way it's supposed to be. And then I asked, well, how am I supposed to be with this? What am I to do? Am I doing what I should be doing? And the answer came back, yes, you're doing exactly what you should be doing. There's something that you have to say about this. And that felt good to me. And then, of course, this is an entity other than myself. So then I decided I'd negotiate to say, well, so how about giving me more time? How about several years? And I got no answer.
So there's the emotional response. Of course, you must have felt wonderful. I mean, I'm sure you would have liked to get the answer, yes, you can have several more years.
Yeah.
But you talked about you were dialoguing with an entity. Do you think there was some intelligence you were communicating with? Was it some deeper part of yourself? Who do you think you were talking to?
So I would default to thinking that that's my own internal wisdom coming up. Granted, that is my own, you know, worldview perspective based on the fact that I'm trained as a scientist. And
and you've been pretty upfront over the years. I mean, as a reductionist scientist. That's kind of how you identify yourself, right?
Yeah.
You are certainly not a conventionally religious person, and I don't know if you think there is some transcendent essence out there, intelligence, but my sense is probably not.
Well, what I do feel very strongly is that we're living within a mystery that far outstrips our science and our ability to understand what's going on. I mean, science makes a wonderful account, and I'm a scientist. I believe in the scientific method, but that certainly doesn't address the nature of consciousness. So we are in this mystery, and I find that to be enthralling. And so that mystery, I think, for some people, is synonymous with ultimate reality, and some people might call it God. I have no idea if that's right, but I do have a great curiosity and a great reverence for the nature of the mystery.
Roland, I want to end where we started. Coming back to your own story, your cancer diagnosis, and you have said that remarkably, in this very visceral way, you have discovered the preciousness of life. In some ways, you've never been happier. And what you're saying, I don't want to be too morbid here, but do you think about how you'd like to die?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot. I don't have a firm vision of that.
You're not going to do the Aldous Huxley thing of taking a big hit of LSD at the moment of your dying?
Actually, someone just gave me Laura Huxley's book where she has a very clear account of that. So when we work with the terminal cancer patients, I would always ask them, and I spent hours with them, and we treated over 50 people. And I would also ask them, what do you think happens when we die? At that point, a curious question for me to ask, because I couldn't put myself in their shoes at all. But some came out with accounts of afterlife, and they're going to go see their mother and their grandparents, and it's going to be beautiful. And some would say they believe in reincarnation, and then others would say nothing happens. Lights out. That's it. Computer's unplugged. And I would ask them, well, what's the probability that that's true? Do you believe that to be completely true? And they say, oh, yeah. I said, well, what percentage would you put on that? And they would say, oh, 95%. And I would think, 5%? That's if you give me 5%, you know, people bet on the lottery at odds of 200 million. if you give me a 5%, you should be really interested in what happens when you die. I think I hold that sense, although I put the probability of afterlife, continuity of consciousness, to be a diminishingly small probability. But it's not a zero probability, because we are in this mystery. And that's all I need. I don't even need 1 in 200 million. I'll take 1 in 10 billion. But to be interested in that process of what it is, because no one knows. And so there's a funny sense I have, actually, that curiosity makes the whole process of dying to be one of interest. So I don't know what that end point looks like. I don't know what I'm ultimately going to succumb to, whether it's some kind of secondary infection or whatever. There's a bodily breakdown. I would hope that it would not be painful. And then it's just a question of being deeply interested. But it feels so important to me to leave with the pieces of my life complete. So the relationships that I have with my children, my grandchildren, my friends, my colleagues, my wife, this legacy project of this research will endure in perpetuity, focused on the very heart of what I'm most interested in, are deeply meaningful to me.
This has been so beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and your experiences and your wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
That's Roland Griffiths, the founding director of the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins University. He died in October of 2023, 10 months after we taped this interview. And that legacy project he mentioned, it's for an endowed psychedelic research program on secular spirituality and well-being to promote human flourishing. You'll find a link on our website at ttbook.org/luminous.